Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. The U.S. Supreme Court is the final arbiter in deciding what laws adhere to the U.S. Constitution and which ones don't. As such, all decisions made by the court are significant. Some, though, have a greater impact on the American people than others. The Supreme Court's latest term ended last week with several rulings that could be determining the nation's politics and representation over the next 10 years. On today's program, we look at some of those cases and a few other rulings. Joining us is Scott Bottery, a constitutional scholar and political scientist at Gettysburg College. Dr. Bottery, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page, on Twitter. We are at Smart Talk WITF. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. And just as a reminder, before we start our conversation on the Supreme Court, coming up in the second half of today's program, I encourage you to call in with your memories. We're going to be talking with WITF's Mike Greenwald about the Apollo 11. 50 years ago this month, Apollo 11, man set foot on the moon. But we'll be talking about in the second half, and we'd like to hear your stories, your memories of where you were and your memories of Apollo 11. That comes up in the second half of the program. Dr. Bottery, as I said, anything the Supreme Court does is significant. As a scholar, someone who follows this on a daily basis, what came out of the last term of the rulings that we heard about, which ones do you think were the most significant?
Well, I think there are several opinions that I would say are significant, but I think one interesting thing from a broader perspective is this is the first full term with the current nine sitting justices. And so we look at, as a scholar, the patterns, the overall broad perspective of, you know, voting blocks, things like that, who's going to vote with who, how are they going to rule. And I think that this term was really interesting from that perspective. We had some atypical voting blocks. Most of the time you'll hear something of a 5-4 decision, and you instantly think, oh, well, it's either liberal or conservative. Who's the swing justice? Who went which way? In this case, we had, or in this term, we had multiple swing justices, which from my point of view is awfully interesting now that Justice Kennedy has retired, replaced by Brett Kavanaugh. Most of the media reports are saying that Chief Justice Roberts is going to be the swing vote. To a certain extent, that was true this term. But there were other swing justices, Neil Gorsuch, Brett Kavanaugh.
You know, something else that may surprise some people, because you're right, we often hear the media reports about those 5-4 decisions and hear that the five conservative justices voted this way, the five liberal or the four liberal justices voted this way. But something that's interesting that many people don't realize is that in this term, where there were 39 cases decided, 39 decisions handed down, there were only 8 that were by 5-4 votes. So those other 31 don't get quite the attention that the 5-4s do.
Yeah, lots of things about this term were typical. They heard about just shy of 70 cases in total. The plurality voting block was a 9-0 unanimous decision. The 5-4 decisions, if we want to get technical, there are about 20, but if we're looking at the 5-4 in the typical sense that we mean, where liberals voted on one side, conservatives voted on the other, there were only 8 cases. So we can count on our fingers the number of times that a 5-4 decision was handed down by the court. And I think the sense in the media is that it's much more than that. Almost every decision is a 5-4 political decision, and that's just not the that's just not the case.
I'm glad you clarified that, because I was under the impression that there were only 8 5-4s, but 8 5-4s when there was the block, the conservative block and the liberal block. All right, so let's talk about some of the cases. Here in Pennsylvania, Pennsylvania has been kind of one of the epicenters, if you will, when it comes to gerrymandering, drawing congressional district maps. And one of the reasons is that the Pennsylvania Supreme Court made a ruling that the maps that were drawn up after the last census were unconstitutional. Now, that was based on the Pennsylvania Constitution. And Supreme Court made a ruling having to do with political gerrymandering that was much anticipated because this has become an issue throughout the country. Pennsylvania may be the epicenter, but in all 50 states, this is an issue. So in Rucho versus Common Cause, what was the ruling?
Yeah, this was a traditional 5-4 split with just Chief Justice Roberts ruling with the other conservative justices. This was a consolidation of two cases. So one dealt from or arose from North Carolina, the other one from Maryland, just south of here. But they come from different political perspectives. So where North Carolina, we had a disproportionate number of Republican districts crafted in a way that favored Republicans. In Maryland, we had the exact opposite. Their districts were crafted in a way that favored Democrats. And so the court consolidated these two cases and heard them together. I will say that this political gerrymandering issue has been one that the court has been tiptoeing around for quite some time. With this, they finally got to, I guess you can say that they came close to the merits, but ultimately they dismissed it as being non-justiciable, being a political question.
Well, okay, let's explore that a little bit more, because I got the sense, especially from those who were advocates for making changes and saying that gerrymandering was widespread across the country, that they were not satisfied with the decision. In fact, I heard the words, what people would say, well, the Supreme Court punted on this one. So what did they base that decision on?
Yeah, so Article 3 of the Constitution, it's by far the shortest article in the Constitution. The framers didn't spend much time caring or thinking about the courts, it seems, if you just read Article 3. But one thing that the framers did restrict the courts to is they can only rule on matters that are genuine cases and controversies. And so from that language, cases and controversies, the court has throughout its history ruled that there are some characteristics that they just won't touch. It's not for a court to decide. So things like an issue being moot, there is in fact no injury, therefore there's no controversy. If both litigants want the same thing, a collusive suit, they won't rule on it. They also won't give advisory opinions. So the idea that before a law is passed, the legislature wants to know about the constitutionality of it, the court won't hear it. And the last one is a political question. This idea that the resolution of this conflict is better left to the political branches to decide. It's for them. It's their job.
And that's what the court based their ruling on here.
That's correct.
So many people here in Pennsylvania said, see, we told you so, that the Pennsylvania Supreme Court overstepped their bounds when they made a decision that Pennsylvania's districts had been gerrymandered for political reasons. But there's a difference here, correct?
Yeah, there is a difference. The one thing that I think is important to really highlight from Roberts' opinion is that he explicitly says, nowhere in our opinion does this foreclose the states from proceeding in the way they have. And in fact, he highlights some of the success stories, Pennsylvania, Arizona, where they're actually making bipartisan commissions to do this in a fair way, which I think is awfully hopeful, this idea that, partisanship isn't ruling the day and we can actually come to a compromise and do this in a fair way. The court is simply saying, that's the way to do it. It's not for us to decide. So we'll leave it to them.
Mm-hmm. So in hindsight, looking at Justice Roberts, Chief Justice Roberts' opinion, for those who said he made a political decision, you're saying that's not the case here.
Well, the political scientist in me does see some strategy behind Chief Justice Roberts' decision. This idea that the Supreme Court is some ultimate arbiter and it speaks and people listen, that's not exactly true. The court is a very weak institution. All it does is release amounts to a book report, to the public and expects the political actors, be it on the federal or state level, to obey it. And it doesn't have an enforcement mechanism. So it can't make a ruling and then make sure it's enforced. You have that famous quote from Jackson saying, Chief Justice Marshall has made his ruling, now let him enforce it. And he just refuses to follow the ruling. This is all to say that the court has to be cognizant of its standing in the public and with the other political actors. It relies on the public to take its rulings as legitimate. It relies on the political actors to actually enforce its rulings. And I think of the nine justices, the one who ought to care most about the legitimacy of the court is the Chief Justice.
Do you think Roberts does that? I mean, there have been reports over the years that he cares a lot about the legacy of his court and does think about what the public opinion of the court is.
Yes, I do think he does that. I think every Chief Justice ought to do it. And we have some really good historical records with the justices after they retire. They donate their notes to college normally. And, you know, the notes they take during conference committees say that, you know, we should be wary about what we rule here, who even authors the opinion, because of the way it might be received by the public.
You know, the timing of this is such that next year there is a presidential election that will be getting probably 90% of the attention from the media. But at the same time, there are all the House seats are up for grabs, and there also will be a census taken next year. Now, next year's congressional elections will not be based. They'll be based on what was drawn up in 2012, but or in here in Pennsylvania, what was drawn up last year or 2 years ago. No, it was last year, I guess. Anyway, that the census is very important in deciding how congressional districts will be drawn. So with all that said, the Supreme Court ruling, how does that have an impact on, there is another ruling about the census. We'll talk about that in a moment. But the congressional districts that will be redrawn.
So a couple things here. So before we get into the decision itself, we were just talking about the Common Cause case. And the way I like to frame that, you know, this idea of political gerrymandering suddenly becoming this key issue, really it goes back to 2008. It was what I'd like to say, the perfect storm of political events. So in 2008, you have a Democrat win the White House. The midterms in 2010, the closest thing we have to a law in political science is that the incumbent president will suffer losses in the midterms. And that's what happened. So the Republicans took hold in 2010, gained power, but it also just so happened to be a census year. And so now the Republicans in power at the state level and federal level were in charge of the census, able to craft these districts in a way that gave them advantage in drawing these districts. If it had gone the other way, if McCain had won in 08, I would bet money that we'd be seeing the same things, but disproportionately benefiting Democrats. And that leads us to the census case itself, which I actually find fascinating. Chief Justice Roberts, again, kind of had this meandering opinion where you thought it was going toward one end, and at the very last section took a left-hand turn and said, but no, we have to send it back for further consideration. The evidence is such that we can't ignore it. And this evidence in this case was the clear evidence that the current administration was trying to do things for political gain rather than just accuracy of the census.
And what in particular they were looking at is whether there would be a question on the census about whether you're an American citizen or not. And the court actually, I don't know, kind of chastised, if you will, the Trump administration. What did they say?
Yeah, it was, they basically, I'm stylizing slightly, they just kind of threw their hands up and says, what do you expect us to do here? Yeah, on its face, the idea of wanting an accurate census is perfectly valid. But the evidence was such that it went well beyond just accuracy. It went beyond how can we do this to make sure that we have political advantage moving forward. And that's where the court refused to turn its head. And so it looked at the evidence and said, it's not for us to ignore this. And so it needs to go back down to the lower court for further consideration. And then a few days later, they removed the question altogether.
Yeah, I was going to say, just this week, it came out that the Trump administration, that they started printing the census information and that question would not be included. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk and some of the shows that we're working on coming up in the next few days. Protecting Pennsylvania's Forest, Poverty While Working, and Cyber Charter Schools. We invite you to share your questions in advance by sending us a voice memo or leaving a voicemail. See what's coming up at WITF.org/smarttalk. And also coming up in the second portion of today's program, we remember the Apollo 11 moon landing with Mike Greenwald of WITF coming up at about 9:35. Later this morning. But during this portion of the program, we're joined by Scott Bottery, a constitutional scholar and political scientist at Gettysburg College, talking about the just completed U.S. Supreme Court term and some of the significant rulings that came out of that term. If you'd like to weigh in, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. All right, just going to follow up on the last two cases we talked about and what it means for 2020 and the 2020 elections. Mentioned the Common Cause case, where the Supreme Court decided that they were not going to make a ruling about political gerrymandering, and then the court did decide that they would not, that the census case, that it was done for political reasons, asking whether Americans or those who are being questioned in the census were Americans, said that it was for political reasons, or they just didn't buy the argument that the Trump administration was making. So, bottom line, what's this mean for 2020?
I think there are a lot of repercussions for 2020, and I think a lot of them also stem from 2016. So in 2016, the Trump campaign made the Supreme Court a cornerstone of its campaign. Somewhere in the lines of 70% of Trump supporters viewed the court as one of the most important issues in their decision calculus. It gets even a little more descriptive when we look at registered voters and the difference in age groups. So young voters compared to older voters. Older voters consider the court more important, upwards of 30 percentage points more. Trump did in fact win, and here we have two new justices on the court for it. And we see a lot of the current Democratic nominees or potential nominees running on the issue of the Supreme Court. So it seems as if they're finally taking it as a serious issue worth talking about.
Yeah, it is something that it's a little bit different, because not very often did you hear candidates running for president talking about, here's what I would do with the Supreme Court. And many of the Democrats, the debates last week, and it did come up during the debates, but on the campaign trail, some of the Democratic candidates have been talking about Roe versus Wade, the decision in 1973 that legalized abortion in this country, that Roe would be a litmus test, that they would, if they became president, that they would not appoint a justice if that justice would be justice opposed Roe or thought that Roe would be struck down. I mean, it's unusual, at least publicly, for a candidate to say, all right, here's one case that this is a litmus test that this would-be justice would have to pass. What about that?
Yeah, so I don't know if it's necessarily unusual, but I think that it's finally out in the open. So in an ideal world, a president wants to put somebody exactly like him or her on the bench so that that justice, the appointed justice, makes decisions exactly as that president would hope. So this suggests this idea of some sort of principal-agent relationship. I appointed you to a job, now I'm your boss and I can tell you what to do. And that's not the case. So when I hear this idea of a litmus test, I kind of chuckle at it, only because once confirmed, the Supreme Court justice serves for the remainder of as long as they want, essentially, unless they get impeached. And so there's really no credibility to this idea of a litmus test. This potential nominee, potential justice, can say, yeah, of course I'm going to uphold Roe, or of course I'm going to uphold issue X. And then once confirmed, what we call agency loss. There's nothing you can do about it. So I can change my mind, rule differently. Tough luck.
You know, and something that has happened, as you're well aware, Dr. Bottery, over the past two centuries, is that many presidents appointed a justice that they thought was going to be in, I won't say in cahoots, but, you know, had their same political ideology. And then once they got on the court, they were more independent. They actually followed the Constitution or, you know, went by the law rather than viewing what was coming down to them through a political lens.
Yeah, we like to call these drifters. Right, so we nominate somebody who thinks who we think is going to be a certain way, and then turns out we're wrong, or it turns out they evolve, and it, you know, history is littered with these. Going back to President Kennedy nominated Justice White, turned out to be conservative for the remainder of his years on the court. We can go to Justice Blackmun, nominated by Nixon. Same thing. He authored
Roe. Nixon actually said about Blackmun, worst decision I ever made.
And Kennedy said about White. Gerald Ford nominated Justice Stevens. George H.W. Bush nominated Justice Souter. All of these were miscalculations by the nominating president. Got a justice that was different than what he had the president expected.
Could that happen today, though? Reason I ask that is because there is so much attention now on the nominees that before Clarence Thomas's nomination in 1991, the public didn't pay attention that much. Well, since 91, almost every justice that has been nominated, there's been so much scrutiny. Could that happen today?
I think you can get a drifter. I think when we look at Justice Thomas, just before him was Robert Bork. And when your last name gets turned into a verb, that's always a bad thing, right? But now justices can get borked. Right after Justice Thomas and everything that went on with that nomination, we had Justice Souter, who was a miscalculation. One of the reasons HW went with Souter was because exactly of what happened with Thomas. So they went with somebody with less of a paper trail. And it turned out to be... there turned out to be consequences to that.
Yeah. Let's take a call from Jim and Enola. Jim, you're on the air.
Hi, Scott. Hi, I wanted to make two comments as briefly as possible. One is, I'm a registered Democrat, but I have to give the Republicans credit because the Republicans have emphasized the importance of courts, and especially the Supreme Court. And while President Obama's chief of staff famously said, I'm not going to waste any political capital on judges. Well, we see where that's gotten us, because a lot of people, I think, held their noses and voted for Trump because of judges, and not many people, it seems, held their noses and voted for Hillary Clinton. And now we see that, you know, just to list two examples, a woman's right to choose is in serious peril, and the Supreme Court has just abdicated the field on gerrymandering. The second point I want to make is the gerrymandering decision. I mean, this is just a true and unwarranted abdication of authority, because, you know, the court is essentially saying, well, it's too hard, it's a political case, so we're not going to decide it. Well, think about some of the political cases that they have decided. Bush versus Gore, they essentially decided the election for George W. Bush. And one man, one vote, how could you get more political than that? It's just silly for them to say this is a political question. In fact, it was a political decision that they made, because they wanted to allow the states to gerrymander as much as possible, because most of the gerrymandering that goes on is in favor of Republicans. Thanks for listening to me.
All right. Thanks, Jim. What do you think, Dr. Broderick?
Yeah, I think he has a point. The people who supported Trump's campaign took the Supreme Court as a real issue. And in fact, soon afterwards has, you know, two lifetime appointments on the Supreme Court. And I think that's why you're seeing such an emphasis on the Democratic side this time around. So I think it is fair to say that by and large, it was not an important issue on the left.
And I also want to follow up on that and again go back to Roe versus Wade. Many Republicans who cared about the judges that would be appointed, the federal and the Supreme Court justices, were thinking about Roe versus Wade. That was the issue that they wanted to see. Yeah, they may have said, yeah, we wanted to see more conservative judges, more conservative rulings. But Roe, for many conservatives, evangelicals especially, that this was an issue that they said, you know what, here's our opportunity to get Roe overturned.
Yep, and the strategy appears to be paying off. I will say that if this issue does reach the court before the next election, before the next retirement, it is going to force the justices to really grapple with some sticky issues with regard to our fundamental right to privacy. So this idea of Roe is really couched on that and that fundamental
right. Well,
talk
about that, if you would, a little bit more.
Sure. In 1965, in a famous Supreme Court case, the court said that although it's not enumerated in our Constitution, lots of other things are that hint at this idea of privacy. Fourth Amendment right to right against unreasonable searches and seizures, for example. And so taken together, all of these various rights evince that we have this fundamental right to privacy. And that idea has spanned not just Roe, but, you know, a right to privacy in our homes. Various other subject matters this has spilled over to. And so when I hear about potentially overruling a precedent such as Roe, I always am curious, I think in my mind's eye, what this opinion could possibly look like without overruling that fundamental right that I think most Americans agree strongly about.
Well, for example, I mean, if you're basically what you're saying is that this would be a more wide-ranging ruling than just focused on a woman's right to choose an abortion or not.
Correct. And when we're dealing with a, quote, fundamental right of any constitutional right, if it's considered fundamental, there's a legal test that the court employs. It's called strict scrutiny. And it's a high hurdle for any government, state or federal, to overcome. They say strict in name, but fatal in practice. Very rarely does law actually pass strict scrutiny.
Let's take a call from Tom. Tom, you're on the air.
Hi. My question is basically an affirmative action question. I'll tell you my position. Under the post-Civil War amendments, affirmative action seems so clearly wrong on a racial basis, and the court has tried to finesse this into social standing or, you know, economic affirmative action. Is there any chance the court has a clear case coming up where they can rule definitively? As Scalia would said, it's, you know, it's so obvious it almost needs no comment. But given the social tenor of the times, it'd be pretty hard to make a definitive ruling outlawing any kind of racial preference. Is anything in the pipeline now that would give the court a chance to make such a statement?
All right, Tom, thank you very much for your call. Dr. Bodwery, what about that?
Not that I know of that's in the pipeline, but there have been a few cases recently that touched on this issue, especially with regard to higher education, especially out of Texas, UT Austin, to be specific. And the court upheld it, and they said this is a factor that could be taken into consideration when ruling on admission standards. Mm. To go back to, I think the previous caller mentioned this idea. I'm losing my place.
talking about politics and the...
Well, this idea of a political question, and it's such a farce. You know, every decision they rule on is a political question if we want to be cynical about it. And I think there's some merit to that. When I teach these ideas of justiciability, you know, I have to be honest with my students and say, you know, these are frustrating doctrines because in one case it will seem to be such a clear political question, or the case is obviously moot. For example, this affirmative action case that was just ruled on a few years ago, but the court rules on it anyway. And so this court chooses when it institutes these doctrines, and it's very inconsistent in how it does it. And so at the beginning of the show, we mentioned the court punting. I think that's why it's gotten that name, because sometimes they do, sometimes they don't, and it can be frustrating as a court observer when they choose to enact one of these justiciability standards and do away with a case without deciding on it.
Final question, Dr. Bader, we want to thank you very much for being with us today. So the next term, and I assume that's in October, what are we looking for? What are you looking for?
I'm still trying to digest this current term.
I know.
For whatever reason, the court always saves the most interesting opinions to last week, and I have a lot to do this summer before I look at next year's docket. But without fail, there are always, you know, I'd say upwards of 10 cases that I think are truly interesting and really force the court to settle an issue of national importance. And so I'll be doing that this summer after looking through the opinions released last week.
Dr. Scott Bader is a constitutional scholar and political scientist at Gettysburg College. Dr. Bader, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk.
Griffin, Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
Roger, Tranquility. We copy you on the ground. You got a bunch of guys about to turn blue. We're breathing again. Thanks a lot.
In July 1969, 50 years ago this month, one of America's greatest scientific accomplishments and one of the most historic events of the 20th century occurred when the astronauts of Apollo 11 landed on the moon. Throughout the month of July, WITF will be commemorating the Apollo 11 mission on both radio and TV, and we'll talk more about those programs in just a few minutes. But first, we want to go back to July 1969, as heard and seen on WITF TV. WITF's Mike Greenwald was at Cape Kennedy, Florida, for the launch of the Saturn V rocket that carried the Apollo 11 astronauts to the moon.
The countdown is now in its final few seconds, so let's watch and listen together. And you can hear the roar in the background. What a beautiful sight, straight as an arrow. And the United States is on its way to its lunar landing mission. And you may be able to hear the applause in the background from these 3,200 newsmen from all over the world. And this is the most fantastic experience of my whole life.
We are joined now by WITF Senior Vice President and current Senior Advisor Mike Greenwald, who witnessed and reported the launch of Apollo 11 at Cape Kennedy in Florida. Mike, welcome to the program.
Good morning. I wasn't the most detached reporter, was I?
Things were a little bit different in 1969.
And I wasn't exactly seasoned at that point.
But at the time, you just said that this was something that, your greatest memory of your life. 50 years later, you still think that way?
Absolutely. Yes. Well, certainly of my professional life, not necessarily my personal life, but it was an extraordinary opportunity for a very young man to be able to do what I did in the presence of the world's media was an amazing opportunity and experience, yes.
So how would you describe that launch today, looking back 50 years?
Well, I would describe it as certainly one of the most important events in the history of man. If we think about what Neil Armstrong said when he stepped foot on the moon, he really set the tone. It was momentous in a way that I think you can't really appreciate until you look back on it. It's kind of sobering to think that it was 50 years ago, July 16th, that launch occurred. But at the time, it was a moment of great anxiety for me to be there live. I knew I had only one shot, no pun intended, to get it right. And so it was certainly a moment of historical significance.
I think that when you look back 50 years, For those who were alive, they'll remember, but for those who aren't, it was a different time. I mean, even though, you know, the country was in the midst of the Vietnam War, there were protests throughout the country against Vietnam and for civil rights. There was a lot of violence in the streets, a lot of civil unrest going on college campuses and in cities across this country. But yet, at the same time that our government is being challenged, institutions were being challenged in 1969, America seemed to have a real pride in the space program. Describe that, if you would.
It's kind of like we were living in parallel universes, I think. I think back to the speech that John F. Kennedy made to Congress, where he announced our plans to land a man on the moon and return him or her safely. And he made that speech in 1961, May of 1961. I was in college at the time, and I remember being completely enamored and enchanted and intrigued by this message to the world, let alone to the country, that we had these aspirations. And at the same time, all of those other things were happening in our country, which were very unhappy. And I think the space program, it was, of course, the Gemini program preceded the Apollo program. But I think it gave every one of us a belief that there could be something better in our world, in our country, and in our world. And so we were able to appreciate and celebrate this enormous, we didn't know it would be an achievement yet, this enormous challenge, at the same time as we were dealing with our nation's deepest problems. So in a way, I think it was an antidote to everything else that was going on. We were able to focus on something better than the other things that were occurring in our lives and causing so much distress.
We have about 15 minutes left in the program, and I want to take this opportunity to tell our listeners, as I mentioned in the introduction, that we're calling this the Summer of Space, commemorating the 50th anniversary of the moon landing in Apollo 11, and we're collecting stories. Actually, we'll devote several programs to this on Smart Talk, but even today, we'd like to hear from you what you remember about Apollo 11. Where were you when Neil Armstrong set foot on the moon, and or even when the Eagle did land on the lunar surface, maybe even the launch? Tell us about what you were doing at the time and your memories. 1-800-729-7532. That's the number to call, 1-800-729-7532, or you can send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. We have an email here from Valerie. Says, as we talk about this historical mission, please remind your listeners who the real hero in the flight was, the one who made the biggest sacrifice. Without Michael Collins staying in the command module rather than walking on the moon, Armstrong and Aldrin would never have gotten home. I do wonder how NASA made that decision. Michael Collins is kind of like the third man, the one who is forgotten amongst Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin, because those two astronauts walked on the moon while Collins was circling.
Indeed. Indeed.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, Mike, let's go back to when you were there at the launch. Mm-hmm. How did this come to be?
When I started my job as a producer, director, writer, sometimes program host at WITF in 1964, this was before WITF was on the air. I was just out of college, and educational television was only just beginning, and WITF came to be around the time that many other non-commercial educational television stations did. And our entire daytime program schedule for many years was devoted to instructional television programs, using the power of television to help teachers in the classroom do what they do even better. And so our whole daytime program schedule, which was available to anyone off the air, was devoted to these short programs, 15 minutes, 20 minutes, that would help teachers with instruction in math and science and history and the arts. And it was decided here at WITF to produce a weekly background to the news program for various grade levels. So each week, beginning in 1964, it may have been the very first locally produced program, we started a show called Our World in Focus, which was background to the news. And I was the producer, one of the producers, and the host of the program. And so I was on the mailing list for every organization from which I drew information. And of course, the space program was chief among those. Weekly, I would get news releases. I would get film summaries to run into the program. I would get applications for credentials to attend a launch, which always went immediately into the wastebasket because no way in the world would I be able to go to Florida to cover the launch of anything. But when Apollo 11 was announced, and I began to think about the import of that event, I thought, I want to find a way to be there to cover this for my program. And I convinced our general manager, the late Lloyd Kaiser, to give me some gas money and two crew people, an audio person, a film cameraman. Because I had an aunt and uncle who lived in Cocoa Beach, and they agreed to put us up for a couple of days. And so we drove to Florida, and that's how that trip came to be. We were there for, I think, 3 days. We were given our own personal escort. NASA provided an individual who took us anywhere we wanted to be in the days prior to the launch, and then we had a spot in the same position as all of the other world news media, 3 miles from the launch pad at the press site, to do what we did, and that was to cover the actual launch live on film.
So how did you do that? You set up 3 miles, and we actually have, by the way, we have the original video.
Yes.
On our website, WITF.org. You could see it several places, but also on the Smart Talk mm-hmm. page of WITF.org. I think it's about 14 minutes where you're setting up and talking about the Saturn V that you could see. Actually, I didn't realize it was 3 miles away.
That is as close as anyone could be on launch day, was 3 miles. That's where the press site was.
But you still could see it.
Oh, my gosh.
Three miles
and
away.
And feel it. So, you know, I could say that the emotion you heard in that clip was really not my emotion. It was just the rattle in my voice because of the thrust of the rockets. But, no, there was emotion in my voice. But, yes, it was 3 miles away that we could be on launch day. But in those days preceding, when we had our own NASA escort, he took us to all of the primary locations at the Kennedy Space Center. We were in the vehicle assembly building where the Saturn V rocket was assembled. As a matter of fact, there could be 4 Saturn rockets being built at one time in that building. There were 4 enormous bays. As I think back of it, and as I reported in my film report, the next rocket that was being built was Apollo 13.
It's the one
and
that,
we know what happened with Apollo 13.
Well, on Apollo 13, and that was something I wanted to mention to you, is that Apollo 11 was the most historic. It was the first time that man had set foot on the moon. But Apollo 13 today seems to get so much more attention because of the movie.
And because of the tragedy.
Exactly. And it was a great accomplishment being able to get that flight back and those astronauts in one piece.
Right.
So, that was a great accomplishment, too. But in today's culture, it seems as though Apollo 13 gets more attention than Apollo 11. Maybe not this month when we're looking back at 50 years. If you would, describe how big, when you said enormous bays, that Saturn V was huge.
Well, the building, which is still at Cape Canaveral, the Kennedy Space Center at Cape Canaveral, is still there. It's called the Vehicle Assembly Building, and it is as tall or taller than the Saturn V rocket with the landing module at the top. And there are basically 4 quadrants in that building so that 4 of those can be assembled at one time. We were taken into that building. We went up into this elevator that takes you up through the superstructure of the interior of the building. It's an open elevator because it's all catwalks, and it stops at various levels depending on what level of the Saturn V rocket and the spacecraft itself you wanted to see or maintain. And so I don't know how many square feet it was. I probably mentioned it in the film report that we did. But it's larger than you can possibly imagine. So we were taken there. We were taken to look at the Launch Control Center, which looks kind of like the Mission Control Center in Houston, but it's specifically for the launch operations. We were taken to the launch pad before the day of the launch, so I could do a stand-up in front of the launch pad. We were taken everywhere we wanted to be. We just requested it, and our NASA guide took us to wherever we needed to be to do our stand-ups. And then we filled in for the rest of the 15-minute program with file footage that we were not there to shoot ourselves.
So 4 days later, when the Eagle landed at Tranquility Base, and Neil Armstrong walked on the moon with those famous words, you had been, I assume you're back in Pennsylvania.
Yes.
Now.
Yes.
What are you thinking? Could you feel like I have a connection to this because I actually saw this from the beginning?
Absolutely. And not too many years ago, I returned to do a tour of the Kennedy Space Center. And I have to tell you, it was a similarly emotional experience. It was such an important part of my career, and it was such an important event that my memories automatically went back to those 4 days or those 3 days that we spent at Cape Kennedy. And I want to say this. That one of the reasons, going back to your first question about what did it feel like, one of the reasons it felt so extraordinary is that everywhere we went, we were never out of sight of an enormous countdown clock. Now, the world and the nation was already counting down to the date. And then when the day came, the world and the country were already counting down the hours and the minutes. Well, imagine being at that site on those grounds, and no matter where we went from day till night and through the night, enormous countdown clocks, outdoors and indoors, were constant reminders that this moment is about to occur. So our adrenaline was really high, and it was impossible not to feel the anxiety, if not the stress, of what was about to occur.
When we read some of the emails that we've received, Joe from Lidditz says, I was in Central Park, New York, watching with a crowd of excited people on a big screen in Sheep Meadow that was showing what others were watching on TV, getting to hear where everyone was. Mary says, I remember where I was clearly. We were at a lake in Indiana, seated around a small black and white TV on a porch with my cousins and brothers and sisters. I was pretty young, so while it was exciting, the enormity of the event was a little lost to me. I do remember it being a significant event for the adults. Adults in the room were very excited. During the moon landing, my family and I were in the former Yugoslavia. As far as we could tell, the only Americans in a square watching a single television. The place people was almost totally silent, just a few whispers as if in a church, with people now and then sneaking looks at us, some looking away quickly, but most taking time for a quick nod and smile. Everyone was amazed, awed, quiet and respectful. I'll never forget it. Sandy says, I remember my nearly 13-year-old body propped up on pillows on the floor of my house in Memphis watching the moon landing. I was surrounded by boxes. My family was getting ready to move. It always amazes me how vivid this memory is. I was always a news and political junkie, and this was one of the most important news events in my lifetime. I remember I was watching with my mother, and my father was working. My sister, younger sister, was in bed, I believe. But again, black and white TV.
Right.
Of course, the video we were seeing was in black and white.
Yes.
Anyway, but still, black and white TV, and she's right. Sandy's right that those memories are so vivid.
And I've been watching a lot of the programming that's already been broadcast about the Apollo 11 launch. I watched just the other night the CNN documentary called Apollo 11, which was first in movie theaters and now is being streamed on CNN. And every time there was a shot of the press doing what they were doing at that event, I thought about the fact that I was standing there with my back to the rocket waiting for it to be launched, and I'm looking at the trailers lined up from NBC, CBS, ABC, all the world news organizations with their picture windows. And I know that the veterans of the broadcast world were sitting in those in those picture windows, as I was looking into those picture windows, and I'm thinking, what in the world am I doing here?
Well, Mike, we have a whole lot of programming here at WITF coming up over the next month. It starts with Antique Roadshow, Out of This World, a special, Chasing the Moon from American Experience. And coming up on Friday during Smart Talk, for example, we will also have a special radio program that will be coming up at 9 o'clock. But Mike, I hope we get a chance to talk again about this sometime during the month. We go to North Museum in Lancaster in just a few weeks, where we'll be talking about Apollo 11. Mike Greenwald, thank you very much for being with
us
today.
Thanks for having me on.
And I also have to say thank you, Mike, for your service at WITF and providing that for WITF, it was history-making as well. So thank you for that as well, Mike.